From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The White House faces a deadline today, whether or not to send a lawyer to participate in the impeachment proceedings before the House Judiciary Committee. Hearings continue Monday with a presentation of the House Intelligence Committee's report, which concluded that President Trump solicited the interference of a foreign government in the 2020 election. Joining us now is Representative Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana. He's a member of the Judiciary Committee. Congressman, welcome.
Hey, Jeremy. Great to be with you.
And what's going to be your goal in Monday's hearing?
Well, we're still trying to figure out the contours of that hearing and what we will be exposed to. I think we're told that staff will present effectively the Schiff report and at least the top line on that. Our concern is that we still, as you and I are speaking, don't have access to all the underlying evidence that supposedly supports this claim or these allegations that impeachment is necessary. And that's a real problem because the House Judiciary Committee, where I serve, is really the only committee in Congress that has real jurisdiction over this issue. And this is an unprecedented thing for the members to not have access to all of that evidence that's been gathered down in the basement and elsewhere.
You don't think that what's in the 300-page report that the Democrats released is enough?
I don't, because I think that report was engineered by Chairman Schiff. I think it was cherry-picked. I think the reason that they had many or all these witnesses come before them in the basement first and the closed hearings is because that was a dress rehearsal. He has selected the portions and the excerpts and the testimony that he wants to present. And you have to remember that only 3 of 9 Republican witnesses have ever been allowed into this process. It was summarized in the hearing on Wednesday that by Professor Turley that this is the fastest moving impeachment on the thinnest record in the history of our country, and that ought to concern every American.
Well, we asked your colleague, Eric Swalwell, about that yesterday, about what Professor Turley had to say, and he said that one of his concerns and the reason that he feels this is so urgent and needs to move quickly is because if President Trump faces no consequences for what the Democrats see so far as calling a foreign leader and asking for interference in our elections, that Trump could do it again, and he was worried that even Rudy Giuliani has been in Ukraine this week and that there may be more election interference going on.
Listen, the reason the founders set this up in our constitutional republic the way they did, the reason the president has to run for re-election for a second term is because the voters of this country get to make those decisions. They get to review the record and the actions and activities of every administration and on a 4-year term. And so we have one of those coming up now in what, about 11 months now. We ought to let the people make those determinations. And I think that's what my friend Eric Swalwell and my Democrat colleagues are concerned about. They don't want this to be decided at the ballot box. They want to do it themselves. But the problem is they don't have a record to support it. You know, our chairman, Jerry Nadler, the Democrat chairman of our committee, said himself 20 years ago that a single-party impeachment proceeding would be terribly destructive to our country. He seems to have made a 180-degree turn on that view, but we still share it.
But what about the idea that it wouldn't be a fair election if there's election interference going on?
Look, everyone on both sides of the aisle is working to prevent election interference. The president is himself. We know Russia is the main offender there, and we're addressing that. All of us are working together to make sure that happens. We have to have integrity in our system. I just don't think that what they've presented is any evidence of election tampering that has been contributed to in any way or affirmed in any way by the administration. And that ultimately is the question.
Do you have any sense of the timeline beyond Monday at this point?
We don't, and that's kind of one of the outrageous things about this. They seem to be making it up as they go on the other side. The American people have to know at the end, whatever the outcome, that they can trust the process, that it was fair, impartial, and transparent. We don't have any of that here, and that is the real problem.
It's interesting. You're saying that is your view about this process. Democrats would say that that's exactly the reason why they feel they need to impeach the president, is because people need to have faith in the election.
Well, right. But if they genuinely believe that, they would slow this thing down. They would have more deliberate hearings. They would allow balance in the witness list. They would allow cross-examination and, you know, the president's counsel to be involved at every stage. They haven't done that. 17 out of 24 of my Democrat colleagues on the other side of the aisle in the House Judiciary Committee have already voted previously to support moving for impeachment. They didn't come into that hearing with an open mind. And all of us have to recognize that's the reality of this.
So let me finally ask you, do you think that the president should decide to be involved in this part of the process in the House? And they have to decide by 5 o'clock today, according to Chairman Nadler.
Look, if they had any faith at all, any hope that it could be a fair hearing, they should be involved. But if it looks like they're being railroaded, no lawyer in the world would advise them to go and participate in that. I'm an attorney. I would tell my client not to, because it can't be trusted. If they'll have a fair and open process, that's what you would hope. When Ken Starr presented his report in 1998, he came and sat before the House Judiciary Committee, took questions from both sides. The minority party had full access to all the records. He presented 36 boxes of evidence to the Judiciary Committee in 1998. You know how many Chairman Schiff has given to us? Zero. This is not a fair process, and everyone can see that.
That is Congressman Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And let's take a look at some of the other stories from the week through the lens of social media. Femi OK is the host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, good to have you back.
Hi, Peter.
And let's start with this very tragic story, frankly, out of South Texas. A 16-year-old boy from Guatemala died in a Border Patrol holding cell earlier this year. Now, this was back in May, but ProPublica just published a video showing Carlos Hernandez Vasquez, who had been diagnosed with the flu, collapsing and dying in his cell. He lay there for hours, his body not discovered until the morning by his cellmate. People are just outraged about this. What are you seeing?
Well, ProPublica put up the video that they saw of Carlos in the last few hours, and they warn the audience when they look at it online that you will see this young lad actually die. And this is what ProPublica tweeted out today as people were reacting to this story. They didn't take him to hospital. They didn't release him. They didn't even seem to check him as he was dying on the floor of his cell. We have the video. And then reaction to the video was shock, disappointment. This is a kid. How can we let kids die when they're in custody or in facilities where they're being looked after because they have crossed the border without any documentation? Adam Rifkin, for instance, says, Carlos died on U.S. soil due to lethal neglect, and we must never forget. And he shows pictures of Carlos as a youngster. I mean, he was only 16 when he passed away. And then everyone's running Jordan posts on Twitter. That's his Twitter handle. There are murderers on death row who at least have a cot and a blanket and a pillow. And you see the starkness of this facility where Carlos was placed because people realized that he did actually have the flu. So a lot of anger, a lot of pushback, and ProPublica say, we haven't finished reporting of this story yet. So they will continue. And the big deal about this video is it contradicts what the authorities say happened to Carlos and how he passed away.
And unfortunately, as we know, this is an ongoing problem for young people in Border Patrol custody. ProPublica says that CPB has declined to answer any questions about this because of an ongoing investigation. Now, Femi, I want to talk to you about another story that's got people worried this week. And this is about the popular social media video app TikTok. If you are, I guess, over the age of, what, like 22, you may have to Google it.
Just leave
it there.
But the company's a young 22.
Right. The company's
it's
in hot water.
Kids.
It is definitely for the kids. And yet some of those kids are getting filtered out of the platform. Can you explain what's going on?
Yes, a German digital rights blog found out that TikTok was showing some video and not showing others. And the reason they weren't showing other videos was because people were maybe overweight. They looked slightly unusual. They may be from the LGBTQ community and they may be disabled. So you're thinking, why would they do that?
Right.
Well, the TikTok is saying because they know that video posters from these different communities, they get a lot of hate, they get a lot of cyberbullying online, and they flag them. They look at the video for 30 seconds, they decide, does it fall into any of these hate groups, groups of people who are hated, not groups of people who actually hate? And then they put them to one side so that most people can't actually see them. It is a temporary measure to try and stop cyberbullying, but it feels counterintuitive because it almost feels like they're bullying the people who should be able to share their content.
Right. Femi, isn't it fair to say that many of the people who are being filtered out and suppressed, they might say that they don't need any protection because, look, when they're on this platform, they have the freedom to be themselves online. What are you hearing?
Well, they're saying that this is TikTok is saying this is a temporary measure. It's not how we're going to tackle cyberbullying, and we're going to try and fix this. But it does mean that certain people who are using TikTok, in order to get their message out, to show that they have lives, that it's very similar to everybody else's, that they are being censored.
And this matters because TikTok is so popular, 1.5 billion downloads recently reached.
It's huge. It's getting bigger by the day.
YouTube released its 2019 Rewind video yesterday, a compilation of some of the best videos on the platform of the year. Here's how 2019's Rewind opened up.
YouTube Rewind 2018, the most disliked video in the history of YouTube.
We don't have a lot of time here, Femi, but basically, hopefully 2019 was better. Yes, no?
People were just so disappointed. It's just a top 10 list. You didn't even try. And what I love about this is that YouTube actually then did a top 10 list of the comments about their top 10 for 2019. You'll find it on YouTube Rewind. Make up your own mind.
3 million people dislike the 2019 Rewind already. Way more than those
who
like it.
It's on the way to be one of the most disliked videos on YouTube.
Femi,
congratulations, okay. YouTube.
Femi, okay. Thank you so much. This week, we're looking at the housing crisis in a few mid-size cities in the West, where home prices are outpacing wage growth and renters are having trouble keeping up. Yesterday, we heard from a Republican state senator in Utah who said his state's affordable housing fund ran out of money just 4 days into the fiscal year.
That's just the reality of where we're at. The demand is there. It's just we have yet not really, as a state, stepped up to the plate to take on this issue, and that's what we're trying to do.
Today, Missoula, Montana. Aaron Pahan is Director of Housing and Community Development for the City of Missoula. Aaron, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Missoula, we see that the median sales price for a single-family home recently hit a record. It's $305,000. And, you know, as we've been hearing this week, you are not alone across the West. What's going on there in Missoula, where you are?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You know, our problems are not unique, but we're seeing them escalate pretty sharply and working to address that. You know, Missoula does have a few factors that are unique. Geographically, we have some challenges in development that a lot of communities don't have. In the past several years, Missoula has seen remarkable growth in our economy and population. We're a community with incredible people and a very attractive quality of life, but that growth has brought challenges. We're seeing young families to retirees, really more than half of our community that can't afford to participate in the increasingly expensive housing market. And a lot of that comes down to housing supply. Part of what makes this community so attractive is that we are surrounded by picturesque mountain ranges and rivers, open space that really limits our ability to grow. And so we're having to think about how we meet our housing needs in new and different ways.
People outside of Montana may not know this. And again, we've been learning a lot about this this week, that where you are, there is a growing tech sector, a lot of tech jobs coming in and changing the dynamics.
Absolutely. We are seeing a boom in tech industry, especially with startups here in our community. And it is really, in many ways, a fantastic thing. It has brought jobs, very specialized jobs, to our community and high-paying jobs to our community, which in a town like ours, where the median family income hovers around $50,000, jobs like these really impact people's ability and opportunity. What the tech sector also brings, though, are individuals who are seeking housing faster than we are producing that supply.
Probably big, also, nice housing, too.
Yeah. Also, folks who can come in and, you know, put down a cash offer, pay above appraised value for a home. And we're seeing that inflate the market as it inflates appraisals for all the surrounding homes.
You mentioned one of the problems that you have is this lack of land because the city is built in this narrow valley. There's nowhere to really to go. And because of that, it sounds like the city is trying to increase its density. In other words, build up and not out, which, again, in a smaller Western town, city, that could be controversial.
Absolutely. People care about their neighborhoods, and we love that about Missoula. People care about the unique characteristics that make their neighborhoods special. And what we're trying to make sure to relay is that those characteristics can and should remain while allowing Missoula to evolve. Cities have to evolve, and we need to make sure that ours evolves in a way that accommodates people who need homes. The reality is, right now in Missoula, you are allowed to knock down a relatively small, affordable home and build a mansion. That's already allowed today. Mm-hmm. All we're saying is that in addition to being able to build a mansion, perhaps you should also be able to build a duplex or a tiny home to allow for some more affordable options as well.
Oh, but the zoning meetings that you probably have to go to. I mean, look, I've spent a lot of time in smaller towns in the West. I know people are very protective of where they are and the way things have been. And now you're saying you've got people coming in from the coast, from San Francisco, and they're changing the fabric of this community.
Yeah, these conversations are really difficult. Every conversation, every zoning hearing, every new development is a value-based conversation. And we have to decide what kind of community we want to be. As a city, we're doing whatever we can to spur the market by getting out of its way. Essentially, we're looking at what we can eliminate in terms of unnecessary regulation while at the same time protecting our identity and our values around health and inclusivity. At the end of the day, Missoula prides itself in being a working class community, and we want to maintain those working class roots. So I think it's really essential for us that we remain a place for everyone and that our doors remain open.
Well, you say inclusivity, but do you think it's realistic at this pace that everyone who wants to live in Missoula will be able to afford to do that?
I think we're doing everything we can to make sure that that remains a reality. Missoula, in the last several years, has invested significant resource into ensuring just that. We are both doing whatever we can to spur the market and get out of the market's way, while also acknowledging that there are going to be segments of our population that the market's not going to touch. Targeted populations like seniors or people living in chronic homelessness. So in the next 3 years alone, Missoula will develop nearly 500 rental homes that are permanently affordable. In a town our size, that is significant, and that moves the needle and helps us to live our value of inclusivity.
Who's paying for that?
So those projects are paid through a combination of financial resources, some federal, like the low-income housing tax credit, and many local. For example, one of these permanently affordable developments is made possible through a four-acre land investment by Missoula County. He who holds land holds the right to development and can control development patterns. And so it's increasingly important that land, as one of our most valuable assets, continues to go towards development that will ensure that inclusivity.
That's Aaron Pahan, Director of Housing and Community Development for another city that is booming in the western United States, Missoula, Montana. Aaron, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, it's been nearly a year since President Trump signed the 2018 Farm Bill, and one provision in that bill made it legal to grow industrial hemp in the U.S. for the first time in more than 50 years. It has been a steep learning curve for some farmers as they try to figure out how to grow and process the low THC version of the cannabis plant. Liz Reed from member station WESA visited one farmer at a warehouse in western Pennsylvania.
You can smell the hemp long before you can see it.
There is a noticeable smell.
That's Ed Santillan, CEO of AgriFarm LLC.
And I know people that are on the radio can't tell, but what you're smelling today is about only a third of what it really smells like when we first harvest the crop.
We're at AgriFarm's hemp processing facility in Vanport, Pennsylvania, about 30 miles down the Ohio River from Pittsburgh. Hemp, rows and rows of it, stalks as much as 8 feet long, hangs from orange plastic netting to dry. It smells just like marijuana, but there's one big difference, says Chief Operations Officer John Clay. This hemp has way less THC, the psychoactive ingredient in weed that makes you feel high.
We have less than 0.3% THC in our product versus your standard medical marijuana having anywhere from 15 to 40% THC.
Clay reaches out to one of the stalks and crumbles it between his fingers.
And as you see, the seeds can fall right out as this stuff is drying out. And what we'll do is we'll pick the seeds up and we'll run them through our seed processor.
He walks over to one of three seed tables. It's basically a big wooden box on legs filled with the processed seeds, each about the size of a peppercorn. He reaches in and scoops up a handful.
We have approximately 250 pounds of seed in here. And this basically is shed off of these plants, and we haven't even broken the plants down. So, you know, we'll expect to have probably a couple thousand pounds by the time we're done.
Clay says he won't have any problem finding buyers for these hemp seeds. There was a seed shortage this year, he says, and next year demand could be even higher as industrial hemp programs get going in large states like Texas and Florida. But growing hemp for seed wasn't actually the plan. Initially, AgriFarm wanted to plant a seedless strain of hemp to be processed into CBD products, but an exceptionally wet spring foiled that plan, so the company switched gears. Adaptability is key to survival in this business, says Santillan.
We've talked to several farmers who have had total losses of their crop. It's a learning curve for everyone. I think it's important for all farmers to work together to benefit each other and offer our services to each other.
Santillan has big plans for the future. He wants AgriFarm to one day be vertically integrated, from producing the seeds to growing and drying the hemp to extracting the CBD. And he wants to make those services available to other hemp farmers. He's also in talks with people in Ohio, West Virginia, and Maine about partnering to grow hemp in those states. He's plowed about $500,000 into the venture so far and takes me outside to see some of his biggest investments.
Okay, so what's outside?
So outside we have our combine and our John Deere 4050 tractor, our babies.
Big babies.
That's right.
Santillan says his business is about more than turning a profit. He says the hemp industry will bring jobs to rural areas like his, and the products they create have the potential to make life better for people like his wife, who has found that CBD oil reduces her migraine symptoms.
It is. It's exciting. You know, this is the first year that hemp is allowed to be grown as a result of the Farm Act, and everyone that's involved this year has been part of history in the making.
It's a new era, says Santillan. In fact, the local police chief stopped by the morning of my visit. He got a tour of the warehouse, gave the guys some advice on security, and wished them luck. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Reed in Pittsburgh.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations. Thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
The U.S. economy added 266,000 jobs in November, beating economists' expectations. It's also double the gains from October, although some of that has to do with the fact that 40,000 GM workers who were on strike are now back at work. Let's bring in Mike Regan. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Peter.
And as you know, job numbers can bounce around from month to month, but there's no denying that this was a good month. What drove the gains in November?
Yeah, definitely a good month. One really interesting sector that's been, for the past few years, driving these jobs gains is healthcare. And I think that has a lot to do with the aging baby boom population, sort of requiring more doctors and nurses, that sort of thing. But 45,000 jobs added in the month in healthcare, and that's brings the total to over 400,000 over the last 12 months. So that's a real important driver of the job market right now. Otherwise, really noticeable gains in leisure and hospitality. That sector added 45,000 jobs. And financial services, pretty good too. They added about 13,000 jobs in the month.
What about retail? I know the holiday season's coming up.
So obviously retailers add a lot of temporary workers during the holidays, but the Labor Department does what's known as seasonal adjustments. In other words, they try to account for the effect of these temporary workers. And, you know, not just in retail, but for industries that tend to hire less less in winter months, require less workers in the winter months. So taking into account those adjustments, retail was actually pretty flat for the month. It only added a net of about 2,000 jobs.
You know, investors really like this job report. At one point today, stock market was – the Dow was up more than 300 points. That's after the markets were sharply down at the start of the week because there were fears about the trade war extending past the election. What does a job report like this do to, I don't know, temper anxieties about the long-term health of the economy?
Yeah, as you pointed out, that move higher in the market really does suggest that it tempered a lot of those concerns. I mean, a main worry among investors and economists has been that the trade war has caused the manufacturing sector of the economy to be very weak. And that's not a huge part of the economy, but the worry was sort of would it start to bleed over into the much larger services sector of the economy. And so at least for another month, it appears like it's not, like it's just been contained in the manufacturing sector.
Unemployment fell down a little bit to another historic low, 3.5%. We're hearing some frustrations, as we have for a long time, really, from employers who can't find enough people to fill their job openings. But we also have pretty clear indicators that there are some problems in that area. NPR reported yesterday that 15% of men in their prime working years are not working, and that's up from 5% in 1968. So it's not all hunky-dory.
Right. Not necessarily. You know, I think there's been a lot of research into why that male participation rate in the labor force has gone down. Some blame actually the opioid epidemic, and obviously the offshoring of a lot of low-skilled jobs is to blame too. But I would also point out that the percentage of women in the labor force has really grown a lot, especially if you're comparing like our generation to our parents' generation. So, you know, I think you and I probably know a lot more stay-at-home dads than, yeah, say, our fathers did. So I think that's part of the story, too.
Donald Trump tweeted today, "Great jobs report," all caps. You know he's happy. Mike Regan, senior editor of Bloomberg News. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Peter.
British voters will vote in less than a week to decide which party will control Parliament and who will be Prime Minister. Polls show Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party in the lead over the opposition Labour Party, led by Jeremy Corbyn. A key issue, of course, is Brexit. Johnson wants it to happen by the end of January. Corbyn is less clear. He wants to give the people another say. On other issues, Corbyn is running from the left with specific promises like these.
Is it asking too much to have a social care system that doesn't leave our older people isolated and afraid, but instead gives them dignity with free personal care? Is that asking too much? How about a decent pay rise? A real living wage of at least £10 an hour right away?
Jeremy Corbyn has been compared to left-wing politicians in the U.S. like Bernie Sanders. He is a departure from Tony Blair's more centrist style of governing called New Labour, but he's very unpopular despite the popularity of some of his policies. Joining us now is Stephen Fielding, professor of British politics at the University of Nottingham. And Stephen, Corbyn was first elected Labour MP in 1983, but he spent most of his career as a backbencher. How did he become party leader?
The way in which it happened was that Labour had just lost in 2015. It would be the third successive election defeat. And people were saying, look, New Labour was good for a time, but after the banking crisis, the financial crash, there's new politics, austerity, inequality is increasing. We need a new way of dealing with this as a political party. We need to go back to the left, in other words. And his immediate predecessor, Ed Miliband, tried to finesse the difference between New Labour and a more left-wing approach. But that didn't really wash. So in 2015, when Miliband stood down, most Labour members were fed up with maybe compromising with the electorate, or at least sort of centre ground voters, and wanted a kind of true left wing sort of socialist programme. And Jeremy Corbyn was the, I mean, in a way, a kind of dumb beneficiary of this. He didn't expect when he stood for leader that he would win. Most people didn't expect that he would win. I certainly didn't expect it. But there was this kind of frustration with how the party had almost kind of lost its soul during the New Labour years and now wasn't even winning elections. Mm-hmm. So he was kind of an expression of a pent-up frustration.
And in 2017, Labour didn't win, but it did a lot better than anybody predicted. What has happened since then to make Jeremy Corbyn so unpopular?
He did very well in 2017, again, unexpectedly so. People imagined that maybe he would go from strength to strength from that point. I mean, some of his own colleagues said that if only the campaign had gone off 1 week longer, he would have ended up in number 10 in Downing Street as Prime Minister. But since then, I mean, this is something that would have foxed any Labour leader. We've had the Brexit vote, the referendum to leave. And that is something which he has found very, very difficult to deal with. Corbyn's got a very interesting background in this, and it does go back to his 1970s left-wing roots, because the left, the Labour left, were very much against what was then the European Economic Community. And we actually had a referendum in 1975, and Jeremy Corbyn was one of those on the left that voted to leave. So he's actually an original leaver. Mm-hmm. And all the way through the 1980s and the 1990s, he's been criticising the direction of travel of the EU, you know, seeing it as a kind of neoliberal mechanism, a way of increasing competition and basically against socialism in many ways. So he's been a very big critic. So in some ways, he's a paradox. I mean, he's leading a left-wing party, most of whose members and voters want to remain in the EU. But because of his own left-wing ideology, he actually does want Britain to leave. The reason why he's been ambiguous and now he's adopted a neutral position is because he doesn't want to make that difference between his own members and himself too apparent, because that's quite dangerous for him.
When you look at all of the issues that are out there in British politics, there are a lot of issues that Corbyn stands for that the people are behind. Green energy jobs, home care for the elderly, taxing the wealthy. What does it say that he is so unpopular and that Labour has been behind in the polls for this upcoming election, despite how popular his ideas are?
Well, there's a kind of a traditional problem that the left have had in this country, which is a lot of the things they actually stand for are very popular. The Labour Party created our National Health Service. The National Health Service is possibly the single, after the Queen, is possibly the single most popular institution in Britain. And Labour's association with that cannot be broken. History has kind of made that. So Labour is seen usually to be on the side of ordinary people. And because of the way things have gone in terms of the economy and the sense of greater unfairness, many of the proposals that Labour has are, you're absolutely right, individually very, very popular. Mm-hmm. Taking all kinds of industries back into state hands so that the money doesn't go to shareholders, it goes back into profit and to keep prices down, and generally speak to being on the side of ordinary people. The problem for the Labour Party, and this is something that Tony Blair tried to fix, you know, with a kind of laser-like focus, is that people generally don't think Labour's very good at running the economy. So with Corbyn, who stands for individually many policies that people believe in, they look at him and they don't see somebody who is going to be very good at managing the economy. And it's partly to do with how the media has constructed him, partly to do with how he actually looks and how he talks. They don't see him as a conventional political leader. And that's a strength. That has been a strength for him amongst certain voters. It's one reason why he did quite well in 2017. But now in 2019, Labour's message is we're going to spend something like £85 billion extra every year on all these things. And for a lot of people, that's just incredible. They like the ideas, but they just don't believe Labour's really going to do it. And they don't believe it's going to do it well because of Jeremy Corbyn, I would say.
Well, what do you think of the comparison between Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders? A lot of people have made that comparison. They're both outside of the establishment. They don't look like traditional politicians. They're both older white men. Are those comparisons fair?
Oh, yeah. I think in general terms, they most definitely are. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn lived on the margins of his own party for decades. Some people didn't even really consider him a Labour Party member, though he actually was. And obviously, Sanders is not really a Democrat, is he? And they both, I think, have tapped into a frustration with how politics has been going, how the economy has been going, to articulate a kind of a protest against the direction of travel and a demand for things to be reversed at the very least. I think think Jeremy Corbyn, because of the nature of British political culture, which accepts the role of the state much more, I mean, like I say, the National Health Service is one of the most, you know, socialised medicine, is something that even Margaret Thatcher didn't want to tackle directly. And whereas in the United States, well, not so much. So Jeremy Corbyn starts from a further left position because of the nature of British politics. But definitely there are so many parallels between the two, it's uncanny.
How important do you think Brexit is to Jeremy Corbyn's struggles? If there were no Brexit, do you think he would have been more popular in this election?
Brexit hasn't helped. I mean, most definitely it hasn't helped because it split the Labour vote. And I think it's the way in which Jeremy Corbyn managed the Brexit dilemma, the very poor way that he managed the Brexit dilemma, which is really proved very tricky for him. I think any Labour leader would have found it a trouble. So if you can imagine Britain without Brexit, and from where I'm sitting, that is a very difficult thing to do, given we've been living it for 3 years or more. If you can imagine it, I think the landscape would be easier for him because the Labour vote wouldn't be so divided between Remain and Leave. But there would still be some issues, I mean, significant issues of, can we trust Labour with all these promises to deliver on all these things, things that we like? Brexit has got nothing to do with those. So I think things might be easier. And given that this is a very tight election, maybe it could have made a difference.
What's your prediction for what will happen in the election?
Well, the way polls stand today, and we have to be very careful with what polls are saying right now and how things will be in a week's time or so. The way they stand now, it's a Conservative government or a hung parliament with a bias maybe towards a Conservative majority government. So a Conservative government that can get Brexit done in the sense that it could take Britain out of the European Union in January of next year.
Do you think that'll happen?
What,
it's hard to make Brexit predictions, I know.
Well, even with a Conservative government, a majority Conservative government that has the votes in the House of Commons to actually get Britain to leave the EU, there are so many intractable problems. And, you know, then the next phase of negotiations, the new relationship with the EU starts. And so the idea that Brexit can be done by January is, of course, a myth, because Brexit and the consequences of Brexit are going to be with the British for, you know, a decade or more.
That is Stephen Fielding, a professor of British politics at the University of Nottingham in the UK. Thank you so much.
That's okay.
And again, the election in the UK is coming up next Thursday.
A fixture from Chicago's improv comedy scene will make her TV debut this Sunday on Showtime. The show is called Work in Progress. It's written by and stars Abby McEnany, who has never appeared in a TV show before creating this one, but the pilot got so much buzz at the Sundance Film Festival last year that Showtime picked it up. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been watching, and Eric, tell me more. What's this about?
Well, that's a good question. Basically, Abby plays a woman named Abby who is gay and also has a lot of problems with different sort of mental illnesses and compulsions. She has contemplated ending her life. And the series is sort of about her struggling past these complications and these problems to try and forge something that looks like a functional life. And the very first scene is the scene that rivets everybody, where she's talking to her therapist and then realizes her therapist has died while she's been complaining
like
about
mid-sentence, right?
it's so interesting. But we also have this great scene where she's out on a date with a trans man who becomes her love interest on the show, and she meets somebody who's really pivotal in her life.
Okay, let's talk about that. The person that she meets is the real-life Julia Sweeney. Now, for those of people who don't know, Sweeney was the Saturday Night Live cast member who played Pat on the skit It's Pat in the 1990s. Now, Pat was a nerdy, overweight character, and the joke was always that no one could ever figure out Pat's gender. So bear with me. We're going to hear some of that just so people can be familiar with it.
So how old are you, Pat?
30-something. I guess time's ticking away.
Oh, like a biological clock, Pat? Do you have one of those? Or it probably doesn't matter.
Okay, so then McEnany comes face to face with Sweeney, who played Pat. They're at a bar. How does it go down?
So this is interesting. So again, you know, this series is sort of based on an improv project that McEnany did in Chicago. And Julia Sweeney lived in Chicago for a while. And so this is all kind of realistic that they might bump into each other at a bar. But McEnany's character, and I don't know if the real life person is like this too, when she's in the middle of conflict, it can make her get so emotional that she passes out. Mm. And so she's confronting Julia Sweeney and passes out while there.
Falls out of her chair, actually, right?
Exactly. So we have a little bit of the scene where they're sort of in dialogue with each other. Mm. Let's check it out.
Your character, like Pat, was just part of my life for so long in a pretty bad way. So it's just.
Oh, God.
Look, people suck, right?
Yeah, they do. I'm so sorry.
I'm fine with it.
I'm not fine with it. I feel terrible. I didn't mean it to be mean. I think I was really naive. But now I'm like, ugh.
Don't you mean?
I think you mean. Oh man. Oh no.
They're mimicking Pat there, the way the character used to respond.
Exactly. And, you know, what's interesting, so there's an element of the show that is about how McEnany's character, who she looks very masculine. You know, she has sort of a boyish haircut. She's overweight. You know, she doesn't wear dresses. She wears a shirt and pants often. So a sort of a running element of the show is that people often mistake her for a man. When she wants to go to a public restroom, she always has to deal with people who assume that there's a man going into the public restroom, even when she explains that she's female. And so part of this show is about giving you a sense of what life is like for people who are a little different than the types of characters we normally see on television. And then part of this show is about sort of reaching back and asking these questions about how do you regard these elements of entertainment that used to be considered funny and entertaining, but now we've realized made certain marginalized people feel really badly.
Yeah, you know, you make a great point. I remember watching It's Pat on Saturday Night Live when I was young. I loved it at the time, but I went back to listen to some skits to prepare for this interview, and I was cringing it. I mean, it's offensive, frankly. And, you know, it does seem like the show is trying to make a comment on that.
Yeah, and, you know, we're in this moment, I think, where there's a lot of conflict in the comedy space about the desire to want to do that. This show gives you the sense of what it feels like to be that marginalized person and to feel like there's this sort of national joke out there that you are the butt of, and people are constantly using that joke to reference you. And so there's a whole other side to that coin that this show explores.
Yeah, and to that point, Abby McEnany has had a long background in comedy, but she's said that she's never been able to get cast in a TV show or even in a commercial. And now here she is with her own show. How did she do? How is she doing?
I think the show is it's a delicate little gem and a sort of subtle, funny, quirky, charming little show. And I just hope people take the chance to check it out, because it just quietly subverts a lot of the ways that we're used to hearing these stories told on television.
Heavy stuff, but also very funny. The show is work in progress, and it debuts on Showtime this Sunday. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Sure, thank you.
Jeremy, I think the show looks good. I want to see it. I don't have Showtime, so not going to happen.
Get it.
Maybe I will.
There's some great stuff on Showtime.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Democrats will move ahead with drafting articles of impeachment against President Trump.
Our democracy is what is at stake. The president leaves us no choice but to act.
We'll have the latest as impeachment hearings continue next time on Here and Now.